Pulse set it for him. The bullets thudded against the bank.
Dominique, we can't stay here.
I won't leave him,
he said in his thick accent.
Then we've all got to try the river again.
No.
Dominique shook his head emphatically.
We can't swim with him.
Glass looked again toward the jetty.
The Arikara swarmed over now.
There's no time. Dominique.
Glass's tone was urgent now.
If we stay here, we'll all die.
More guns cracked. For an excruciating moment, Dominique said nothing, gently stroking his brother's ashen cheek. Lavierge stared peacefully ahead, a dim light glinting in his eyes. Finally, Dominique turned to Glass.
I won't leave him.
More guns. Glass fought a collision of instincts. He needed time, time to think through his action, time to justify it. But there was none. Rifle in hand, he dove into the river. Dominique heard a whining sound and felt a bullet bury itself in his shoulder. He thought about the horrible stories he had heard of Indian mutilations. He looked down at Lavierge.
I won't let them cut us up.
He grabbed his brother under the arms and dragged him into the river. Another bullet crashed into his back.
Don't worry, little brother,
he whispered, leaning back into the current's welcoming arms.
It's all downstream from here.
18. December 6th, 1823. Glass squatted naked next to the small fire, as close to the flame as he could bear. He cupped his hands to capture the heat. He held them close, waiting until the last instant before he was certain his skin would blister, then pressed the hot flesh against his shoulders or thighs. The heat seeped in for a moment, but failed to penetrate the chill instilled in him by the icy waters of the Missouri. His clothing hung on crude racks around three sides of the fire. The buckskins remained soggy, though he noted with relief that his cotton shirt was almost dry. He had floated nearly a mile downstream before climbing out into the thickest stand of brush he could find. He burrowed into the center of the bramble on a trail cut by rabbits, hopeful that no larger animal would follow. Within the tangle of willows and driftwood, he found himself once again taking somber inventory of his wounds and his possessions. By comparison to the recent past, Glass felt considerable relief. He had a number of bruises and abrasions from the fight on the banks and the flight down the river. He even discovered a wound on his arm where it appeared that a bullet had grazed him. His old wounds ached in the cold, but did not appear otherwise aggravated, except for the possibility that he would freeze to death, a possibility that seemed very real. He had managed to survive the Arikara attack. For an instant, he saw again the image of Dominique and Lavierge huddled on the cut bank. He pushed the thought from his mind. As for his possessions, the most significant loss was his pistol. His rifle was soaked, but serviceable. He had his knife and his possibles bag with flint and steel. He had his hatchet, which he used to shave kindling into a shallow pit. He hoped his powder was dry. He uncapped his powder horn and poured a dab on the ground. He set a flame to it from the fire, and the powder ignited with a smell like rotten eggs. His satchel was gone, with his spare shirt, blanket, and mittens. The satchel also contained his hand-sketched map, carefully marking the tributaries and landmarks of the Upper Missouri. It mattered little, since he remembered them by heart. Relatively speaking, he felt well-equipped. Though still damp, he decided to put on his cotton shirt. At least the weight of the cloth helped take the chill off his aching shoulder. Glass tended the fire for the rest of the day. He worried about the smoke it created, but he worried more about catching his death of cold. He tended his rifle to take his mind off the chill, drying it completely and applying grease from a small container in his possibles bag. By nighttime, his clothing and rifle were ready. He considered moving only at night.
Somewhere nearby lurked the same Arikara that attacked the camp. He hated just sitting there, even if his position was well concealed. But there was no moon to light a path along the rough bank of the Missouri. He had no choice but to wait until morning. As daylight faded, Glass took the clothes from the willow rack and dressed himself. Next, he scooped a shallow, square pit near the fire. He used two sticks to remove scorching hot stones from a ring around the flames, arranged them in the pit, and then covered them with a thin layer of dirt. He added as much wood to the fire as he dared, then lay down on top of the seething stones. Between the mostly dry buckskins, the stones, the fire, and sheer exhaustion, he crossed a minimal threshold for warmth that permitted his body to sleep. For 2 days, Glass crept up the Missouri. For a while, he wrestled with the question of whether he had inherited responsibility for Langevin's mission with the Arikara. He finally decided that he had not. Glass's commitment to Brazeau had been to provide game for the deputation, a task he had dutifully performed. He had no idea whether Elk Tongue's band represented the intentions of the other Arikara. It mattered little. The ambush underscored the vulnerability of slogging upriver by boat. Even if he received assurances from some faction of the Arikara, he had no intention of returning to Fort Brazeau. His own business was more pressing. Glass guessed, correctly, that the Mandan village lay nearby. Though the Mandan were known as peaceful, he worried about the effect of their new alliance with the Arikara.
Would the Arikara be present in the Mandan village?
How might the attack on the Voyageurs have been portrayed? Glass saw no reason to find out. He knew that a small trading post called Fort Talbot lay 10 miles up the Missouri from the Mandan village. He decided to skirt the Mandans altogether, aiming instead for Fort Talbot. The few supplies he wanted, a blanket and a pair of mittens, he could find at the fort. On the evening of the second day after the attack, Glass decided that he could no longer avoid the risk of hunting. He was ravenous, and a hide would also give him something to trade. He found elk tracks near the river and followed them through a grove of cottonwoods into a large clearing, flanking the river for half a mile. A small stream parceled the clearing in two. Grazing near the stream, Glass could see a large bull, along with 2 cows and 3 fat calves. Glass worked his way slowly through the clearing. He was almost within range when something spooked the elk. All 6 stood, staring in the direction of Glass. Glass started to shoot when he realized that the elk weren't looking at him. They were looking behind him. Glass looked over his shoulder to find 3 mounted Indians emerging from the cottonwoods a quarter mile back. Even at that distance, Glass could make out the spiked hairstyle worn by Arikara braves. He could see the Indians pointing as they kicked their horses and galloped toward him. He desperately looked around for any source of cover. The closest trees stood more than 200 yards in front of him. He would never cover the ground in time, nor could he make it to the river. He was cut off. He could stand and shoot, but even if he hit his target, he could never reload in time to hit all 3 riders, probably not even 2. In desperation, he ran for the distant trees, ignoring the pain that shot up his leg. Glass had barely covered 30 yards when he pulled up in dread. Another mounted Indian stepped from the cover of the cottonwoods in front of him. He looked back. The charging Arikara had covered half the distance between them. He looked again toward the new rider, now aiming down the barrel of his gun. The new rider fired. Glass winced in anticipation of the shot, but it flew high over his head. He turned back toward the Arikara. One of their horses was down. The Indian in front of him had shot at the other 3. Now the shooter galloped toward him, and Glass realized he was Mandan. Glass had no idea why, but the Mandan appeared to be coming to his aid. Glass spun to face his attackers. The 2 remaining Arikara had closed to within 150 yards. Glass cocked his rifle and aimed. At first, he tried to line his sights on one of the riders, but both Arikara hunched low behind their ponies' heads. He moved his aim to one of the horses, picking the hollow spot just below the neck. He squeezed the trigger, and the rifle spit forth his shot. The horse screamed, and its legs seemed to fold in front of it. Dust flew as it plowed to an abrupt stop, its rider flying over the dead animal's head. Glass heard the pounding of hooves and looked up at the Mandan, who motioned him to jump on the horse. He leapt up, looking back to see the remaining Arikara rider rein his mount, firing a shot that missed. The Mandan kicked his horse, and they broke for the trees. He turned the horse when they reached the cottonwoods. Both men dismounted to reload their rifles.
"Rees,"
said the Indian, pointing in their direction.
"No good."
Glass nodded as he rammed a new charge home.
"Mandan,"
said the Indian, pointing to himself.
"Good, friendly."
Glass aimed at the Arikara, but the sole remaining rider had retreated out of range. The two mountless Indians flanked him on either side. The loss of two horses had stolen their appetite for pursuit. The Mandan called himself Mande Pachu. He had been tracking the elk when he had stumbled across Glass and the Arikara. Mande Pachu had a good idea where the scarred white man came from. Only the day before, the translator Charbonneau had arrived in the Mandan village. Well known to the Mandans from his time with Lewis and Clark, Charbonneau related the story of the Arikara attack on the voyageurs. Matutope, a Mandan chief, had been furious with Elk Tongue and his renegade band. Like the trader Kiowa Brazo, Chief Matutope wanted the Missouri open for business. Though he understood Elk Tongue's anger, clearly the voyageurs meant no harm. In fact, according to Charbonneau, they had come bearing gifts and an offer of peace. Matutope had feared exactly this type of incident when the Arikara came seeking a new home. The Mandan relied increasingly on commerce with the white man. There had been no traffic from the south since Leavenworth's attack on the Arikara. Now word of this newest incident would keep the river closed. Word of Chief Matutope's anger spread quickly through the Mandan village. The young Mande Pachu saw the rescue of Glass as an opportunity to gain favor with the chief. Matutope had a beautiful daughter, for whose affection Mande Pachu had been competing. He pictured himself parading through the village with his new trophy, delivering the white man to Matutope, the entire village looking on as he recounted his tale. The white man, though, seemed to suspect the detour. He doggedly repeated a single phrase, "Fort Talbot." From his vantage point on the back of his horse, Glass regarded Mande Pachu with keen interest. Though he had heard many stories, he had never seen a Mandan in the flesh. The young brave wore his hair like a crown, a preening mane to which he obviously devoted considerable attention. A long ponytail wrapped in strips of rabbit skin trailed down his back. On the top of his head, his hair hung loose, flowing like water over the sides, plastered down with grease and cut bluntly at the jawline. In the center of his forehead, a forelock had also been greased and combed. There were other gaudy adornments. Large pewter earrings tugged at three gaping holes where his right ear had been pierced. A choker of white beads contrasted sharply against the copper skin of his neck. Reluctantly, Mande Pachu decided to take the white man to Fort Talbot. It was close, barely 3 hours' ride. Besides, perhaps he could learn something at the fort. There had been rumors of an incident with the Arikara at Fort Talbot. Perhaps the fort would want to pass a message to Matutope. It was a big responsibility, passing messages. Between the story about the white man and the important message he would no doubt be carrying, Matutope would be pleased. His daughter could not help but be impressed. It was almost midnight when the onyx profile of Fort Talbot loomed up suddenly against the featureless night. The fort cast no light onto the plain, and Glass was surprised to find himself only 100 yards from the log ramparts. They saw a flash of fire, and at the same instant heard the sharp crack of a rifle from the fort. A musket ball whined inches above their heads. The horse jumped, and Mande Pachu struggled to control it. Glass mustered his voice, calling out angrily, "Hold your fire! We're friendly!" A voice answered suspiciously from the blockhouse.
"Who are you?"
Glass saw a glimmer of light off the barrel of a rifle, and the dark form of a man's head and shoulders.
"I'm Hugh Glass, with the Rocky Mountain Fur Company."
He wished that he could still project strength with his voice. As it was, he could barely make himself heard across even this short distance.
"Who's the savage?" He's a Mandan. He just saved me from 3 Arikara warriors.
The man on the tower yelled something, and Glass heard fragments of a conversation. 3 more men with rifles appeared on the blockhouse. Glass heard noise behind the heavy gate. A small wicket opened, and they felt themselves again under scrutiny. From the wicket, a gruff new voice demanded,
"Right up here where we can see you better."
Mandepachu nudged the horse forward, reining in front of the gate. Glass dismounted and said,
"Any particular reason you're so trigger-happy?"
The gruff voice said,
"My partner was murdered by Reese in front of this gate last week."
"Well, neither one of us is a Rickera."
"Wouldn't know that, sneaking around in the dark."
In contrast to Fort Brazeau, Fort Talbot felt like a place under siege. Its log walls rose 12 feet around a rectangular perimeter, perhaps 100 feet on the long sides, and no more than 70 on the short ones. 2 crude blockhouses stood on diagonally opposite corners, built so that their innermost corner touched the outermost corner of the fort. From this abutted position, they commanded all 4 walls. 1 of the blockhouses, the one above them, had a crude roof, evidently built to protect a large-bore swivel gun from the elements. The other had the beginnings of a roof that had never been completed. A rough corral backed up to the fort on one side, though no stock grazed within. Glass waited while the eyes behind the wicket continued their scrutiny.
"What's your business?"
asked the gruff voice.
"I'm bound for Fort Union. I need a few provisions."
"Well, we ain't got much to provide."
"I don't need food or powder. Just a blanket and mittens, and I'll be on my way."
"Don't appear that you've got much to trade."
"I can sign a draft for a generous price on behalf of William Ashley. The Rocky Mountain Fur Company will be sending a party downriver in the spring. They'll make good on the draft."
There followed a long pause. Glass added,
"And they'll look favorably on a post that gives aid to one of their men."
Another pause, then the wicket closed. They heard the movement of heavy timber, and the gate began to yawn on its hinge. The gruff voice attached itself to a runt of a man who appeared to be in charge. He stood there with a rifle and 2 pistols at his belt.
"Just you. No red niggers in my fort."
Glass looked at Mandepachu, wondering how much the Mandan understood. Glass started to say something, then stopped, proceeding inside as the gate slammed closed behind him. 2 ramshackle structures stood inside the walls. From one of them, the faint glow of light seeped through the greased hides that served as windows. The other building was dark, and Glass assumed they used it for storage. The rear walls of the buildings served as the back wall of the fort. Their fronts faced a tiny courtyard, dominated by the stench of dung. The source of the odor stood hitched to a post. 2 mangy mules, presumably the only animals that the Arikara had been unable to steal. In addition to the animals, the courtyard held a large machine for pressing pelts, an anvil on a cottonwood stump, and a teetering pile of firewood. 5 men stood inside, soon joined by the man from the blockhouse. The dim light illuminated Glass's scarred face, and Glass felt their curious stares.
"Come inside if you want."
Glass followed the men into the lit structure, crowding into a cramped room configured as a bunkhouse. A smoky fire burned in a crude clay fireplace against the back wall. The only redeeming quality of the sour-smelling room was its warmth, a heat generated as much by the proximity of other men as by the fire. The runty man started to say something more when his body contorted in a deep, wet cough. A similar cough appeared to afflict most of the men, and Glass feared the source. When the runty man finally stopped hacking, he said again,
"We ain't got no food to spare."
"I told you, I don't need your food," said Glass. "Let's settle on the price of a blanket and mittens, and I'll be gone."
Glass pointed to a table in the corner.
"Throw in that skinning knife."
The runty man puffed his chest as if offended.
"We ain't meaning to be stingy, mister, but the Rees got us holed up in here. Stole all our stock. Last week, 5 Braves come riding up to the gate like they want to trade. We open the gate and they start shooting. Killed my partner in cold blood.
Glass said nothing, so the man continued.
We haven't been able to get out to hunt or cut wood, so you'll understand if we're frugal with our supplies.
He kept looking at Glass for affirmation, but Glass offered none. Finally, Glass said,
Shooting a white man and a Mandan won't fix your problem with the Rees.
The shooter spoke up, a filthy man with no front teeth.
All I seen was some Indian slinking around in the middle of the night. How was I to know you're riding double?
You might make a habit of being able to see your target before you shoot.
The runty man spoke again.
I tell my men when to shoot, mister. The Rees and the Mandans ain't never looked no different to me. Besides, they're fortin' up together now, one big thievin' tribe. I'd rather shoot the wrong one than trust the wrong one.
Words began to spill from the runty man like water from a broken dam, and he pointed a bony finger as he spoke.
I built this fort with my own hands, and I got a license to trade here from the governor of Missouri. We ain't leaving, and we'll shoot anything red that falls in our sights. I don't care if we have to kill every damn one of those murdering, thieving bastards.
Who exactly do you plan on trading with?
We'll make our way, mister. This is prime property. The army will come up here before long and set these savages straight. There'll be plenty of white men trading up and down this river. You said it yourself.
Glass stepped into the night, and the gate slammed behind him. He exhaled deeply, watching as his breath condensed in the cold night air, then drifted away on the hint of a frozen breeze. He saw Mandapachu on his horse by the river. The Indian turned at the sound of the gate and rode forward. Glass took the new skinning knife and cut a slit in the blanket, poking his head through and wearing it as a capote. He put his hands into the furry mittens, staring at the Mandan and wondering what to say. What was there to say, really?
I have my own business to attend.
He couldn't right every wrong in his path. Finally, he handed the skinning knife to Mandapachu.
Thank you, said Glass.
The Mandan looked at the knife, and then looked at Glass, searching his eyes. Then he watched as Glass turned and walked away up the Missouri and into the night. 19. December 8th, 1823. John Fitzgerald walked to his sentry post just down the river from Fort Union. Pig stood there, his heaving chest sending great clouds of his breath into the frigid night air.
My watch, said Fitzgerald,
practically friendly in his tone.
Since when are you so cheery about standing watch?
Asked Pig, then ambled toward camp, looking forward to the 4 hours of sleep before breakfast. Fitzgerald cut a thick plug of tobacco. The rich flavor filled his mouth and calmed his nerves. He waited a long time before he spit. The night air bit at his lungs when he breathed, but Fitzgerald didn't mind the cold. The cold was a function of a perfectly clear sky, and Fitzgerald needed a clear sky. A 3/4 moon cast bright light on the river, enough light, he hoped, to steer a clear channel. Half an hour after the change of the guard, Fitzgerald walked to the thick willows where he had cached his plunder. A pack of beaver pelts to trade downstream, 20 pounds of jerky in a jute sack, 3 horns of powder, 100 lead balls, a small cooking pot, and 2 wool blankets, and, of course, the Anstalt. He piled the supplies next to the water's edge, then turned upstream to get the canoe. As he crept along the riverbank, he wondered if Captain Henry would bother sending anyone after him. Stupid bastard. Fitzgerald had never met a man more likely to catch the tail end of a lightning bolt. Under Henry's star-crossed leadership, the men of the Rocky Mountain Fur Company never stood more than a short step from calamity.
It's a wonder we're not all dead.
They were down to 3 horses, which limited the reach of their trapping parties to a few local waters, long since played out. Henry's numerous efforts to trade with the local tribes for new mounts, or in many cases to buy back their own stolen mounts, met with uniform failure. Finding food each day for 30 men had become a problem. The hunting parties had not seen buffalo for weeks, and their primary subsistence now consisted of stringy antelope. The final straw came the week before, when Fitzgerald heard a whispered rumor from Stubby Bill.
"Captain's thinking about moving us up the Yellowstone, occupy what's left of Lisa's old fort on the Bighorn."
In 1807, a cagey trader named Manuel Lisa established a trading post at the junction of the Yellowstone and the Bighorn Rivers. Lisa named his structure Fort Manuel and used it as a base for trade and exploration of both rivers. Lisa maintained particularly good relations with the Crow and the Flathead, who used the guns they bought from Lisa to wage war on the Blackfeet. The Blackfeet, in turn, became bitter enemies of the whites. Encouraged by his modest commercial success, in 1809, Lisa founded the St. Louis, Missouri Fur Company. One of the new venture's investors was Andrew Henry. Henry led a party of 100 trappers on his ill-fated venture to the Three Forks. On his way up the Yellowstone, Henry had stopped at Fort Manuel. He remembered the strategic location, ample game and timber. Henry knew that Fort Manuel had been abandoned for more than a dozen years, but he hoped to salvage the beginnings of a new post. Fitzgerald did not know the distance to the Bighorn, but he knew it lay in the opposite direction from where he wanted to go. While frontier life had been more agreeable than he expected when he fled St. Louis, he had long since grown weary of the bad food, the cold, and the general discomfort of fording up with 30 smelly men. Not to mention the considerable chance of getting killed. He missed the taste of cheap whiskey and the smell of cheap perfume. And with $70 in gold coins, the bounty for tending Glass, he thought constantly about gambling. After a year and a half, things should have quieted down for him in St. Louis, perhaps even farther south. He intended to find out. Two dugout canoes lay upside down on the long beach below the fort. Fitzgerald had examined them thoroughly a few days before, determined that the smaller of the two was better made. Besides, though the downstream current would carry him, he needed a vessel small enough to manage on his own. He quietly flipped the canoe, set its two paddles inside, and pulled it across the sandbar to the water's edge.
"Now, the other."
In planning his desertion, Fitzgerald had worried about how to immobilize the second canoe. He considered boring a hole through the log skin before arriving at a more straightforward solution. He returned to the second canoe, reaching underneath to grab its paddles.
"Canoe's no good without a paddle."
Fitzgerald pushed his canoe into the water, jumped aboard, and paddled twice to set the boat in the current. The water grabbed the canoe and propelled it downstream. He stopped, after a few minutes, to pick up his stolen provisions, then put the boat in the current again. In a matter of minutes, Fort Union disappeared behind him. Captain Henry sat alone in the musty confines of his quarters, the only private room at Fort Union. Beyond privacy, a rare commodity at the fort, there was little to commend the space. The only heat and light came from an open doorway to the adjoining room. Henry sat in the cold and dark, wondering what to do. Fitzgerald himself was no great loss. Henry had distrusted the man since the first day in St. Louis. They could do without the canoe. It wasn't as if he'd stolen their remaining horses. The loss of a fur pack was maddening, but hardly fatal. The loss was not the man who was gone, but rather its effect on the men who stayed. Fitzgerald's desertion was a statement loud and clear of the other men's unspoken thoughts. The Rocky Mountain Fur Company was a failure. He was a failure. Now what? Henry heard the latch open on the bunkhouse door. Short, heavy footsteps scuffed across the dirt floor toward his quarters. Then Stubby Bill stood in the doorway.
"Murphy and the trapping party's coming in," reported Stubby. "They got any clues?"
"No, Captain."
"None at all?"
"No, Captain."
"Well, you see, Captain, it's a little worse than just that."
"Well?"
They ain't got no horses, either. Captain Henry took a moment to absorb the news. Anything else? Stubby thought a minute, and then said,
Yes, Captain.
Anderson is dead. The captain said nothing further. Stubby waited until the silence made him uncomfortable, then he left. Captain Henry sat there for a few more minutes in the cold darkness before making his decision. They would abandon Fort Union. 20. December 15th, 1823. The hollow formed a near-perfect bowl on the floor of the plains. On three sides, low hills rose to shelter the depression from the relentless winds of more open ground. The hollow funneled moisture toward its center, where a stand of hawthorn trees stood vigil. The combination of the hills and the trees created considerable shelter. The little hollow stood barely 50 yards from the Missouri. Hugh Glass sat cross-legged behind a small fire, the flames tickling at the lean carcass of a rabbit suspended on a willow spit. As he waited for the rabbit to roast, Glass became suddenly aware of the sound of the river. It was an odd thing to notice, he thought. He had clung to the river for weeks, yet suddenly he heard the waters with the acute sensitivity of new discovery. He turned from the fire to stare at the river. It struck him as strange that the smooth flow of water would create any sound at all, or that the wind would, for that matter. It occurred to him that it wasn't so much the water or the wind that accounted for the noise, but rather the objects in their path. He turned back to the fire. Glass felt the familiar soreness in his leg and adjusted his position. His wounds posed constant reminders that while he was healing, he was not healed. The cold accentuated the ache in both his leg and his shoulder. He assumed now that his voice would never return to normal. And of course, his face gave permanent notice of his encounter on the Grand. It wasn't all bad, though. His back no longer caused him pain, nor did it hurt to eat, something he appreciated as he inhaled the scent of the roasting meat. Glass had shot the rabbit a few minutes earlier in the fading light of the day. He'd seen no sign of Indians for a week, and when the fat cottontail loped across his path, the prospect of such a tasty dinner had been too much to pass up. A quarter mile upriver from Glass, John Fitzgerald had been watching for a spot to put ashore when he heard the nearby crack of the rifle. Shit! He paddled quickly toward the shore to slow his forward drift. He bobbed in an eddy, backpaddling as he peered through the dimming light to identify the source of the shot.
Too far north for Arikara.
Assiniboine. Fitzgerald wished he could see better. The flicker of a campfire appeared a few minutes later. He could make out the buckskin form of a man, but could discern no detail. He assumed it was an Indian. Certainly no white man had business this far north, not in December, anyway.
Are there more than one?
Daylight faded rapidly. Fitzgerald weighed the options. He sure as hell couldn't stay where he was. If he put ashore for the night, it seemed likely that the shooter would discover him in the morning. He thought about creeping up and killing the shooter, except he still wasn't sure whether he faced one man or many. Finally, he decided to attempt slipping past. He would wait for the cover of nightfall and hope the distraction of the fire would keep the shooter's eye, and any others, off the water. Meanwhile, the full moon would provide enough light to steer. Fitzgerald waited almost an hour, quietly pulling the prow of the dugout onto the soft sandbar. The western horizon swallowed the final remnants of daylight, sharpening the glow of the campfire. The shooter's silhouette hunched above the fire, and Fitzgerald assumed that he must be busy tending his dinner.
Now.
Fitzgerald checked the Anstatt and his two pistols, setting them within easy reach. Then he pulled the dugout off the bank and jumped aboard. He paddled twice to push the boat into the current. After that, he used the paddle as a rudder, gently placing it on one side or the other. As much as he could, he let the boat drift. Hugh Glass tugged at the rabbit's hind quarter. The joint was loose, and with a twist, he tore off the leg. He sunk his teeth into the succulent meat. Fitzgerald tried to steer as far away from the shoreline as possible, but the current ran practically beside it. The fire approached now with dizzying speed. Fitzgerald tried to watch the river while simultaneously peering at the back of the man by the fire. He could make out a capote made from a Hudson's Bay blanket, and what looked like a wool hat. A wool hat? A white man? Fitzgerald looked back toward the water. A giant boulder loomed suddenly from the dark waters of the river, barely 10 feet in front of him. Fitzgerald thrust his paddle deep into the river, pulling as hard as he could. He lifted the paddle at the end of the stroke and pushed it against the rock. The dugout turned, but not enough. Its sides scraped the rock with a rasping grate. Fitzgerald paddled with all his strength. No point holding back now. Glass heard a splash, followed by a long scrape. He reached instinctively for his rifle, then turned toward the Missouri, moving quickly away from the light of the fire. He crept rapidly toward the river, his eyes adjusting from the glare of the firelight. He scanned the water for the source of the sound. He heard the splash of a paddle and could just make out a canoe at a distance of 100 yards. He raised his rifle, cocking the hammer and sighting on the dark form of a man with a paddle. His finger moved inside the trigger guard. He stopped. Glass saw little point in shooting. Whoever it was, the boatman appeared intent on avoiding contact. In any event, he was headed rapidly in the opposite direction. Whatever his intention, the fleeing boatman appeared to pose little threat to Glass. On board the dugout, Fitzgerald paddled hard until he rounded a bend in the river, a quarter mile from the campfire. He let the dugout drift for almost a mile before guiding the boat to the opposite bank and searching for a suitable landing. Finally, he pushed the dugout from the water and flipped it, spreading his bedroll underneath. He chewed on a piece of jerky while he contemplated again the figure by the fire. Damn strange spot for a white man in December. Fitzgerald carefully lay the rifle and his two pistols beside him before curling beneath his blanket. The bright moon flooded his campsite with pale light. The Anstatt caught the light and held it, the silver fittings gleaming like mirrors in the sun. Captain Henry finally caught a stretch of good luck. So many good things happened with such rapid succession that he barely knew what to make of it. For starters, the skies shone blue as indigo for 2 straight weeks. With the good weather, the brigade covered the 200 miles between Fort Union and the Bighorn River in 6 days. When they arrived, the abandoned fort stood almost as Henry remembered it. The condition of the post far exceeded his expectations. The years of abandonment had worn on the structure, but most of the timber remained solid. The find would save them weeks of hard labor, cutting and hauling logs. Henry's experience with the local tribes, at least initially, presented another stark contrast to his dismal fortune at Fort Union. He dispatched a party led by Alistair Murphy and showered gifts on his new neighbors, primarily bands of Flathead and Crow. In his relations with the local Indians, Henry discovered that he was the beneficiary of his predecessor's diplomacy. Both tribes seemed relatively happy at the resettlement of the post. At least, they were willing to trade. The Crow, in particular, were flush with horses. Murphy traded for 72 of the animals. Streams spilled off the nearby Bighorn Mountains, and Captain Henry set out a plan for the aggressive deployment of his newly mobile trappers. For 2 weeks, Henry kept checking his back, as if misfortune must be stalking him from behind. He allowed himself the smallest bit of optimism. Maybe my luck has changed? It had not. Hugh Glass stood before the remnants of Fort Union. The gate itself lay flat on the ground, its hinge carried off when Captain Henry abandoned the post. The indignities of the failed venture continued inside. All of the metal hinges had been removed, salvaged, Glass assumed, for use at their next destination. Logs had been torn from the palisades, apparently used as firewood by the boorish visitors who followed Henry's departure. One of the bunkhouses had a blackened wall from what appeared to be a half-hearted attempt to fire the fort. Dozens of horse tracks had churned the snow in the yard.
I'm chasing a mirage.
How many days had he walked, crawled toward this moment? He thought back to the clearing by the spring on the Grand River.
What month was that? August? What is it now, December?
Glass climbed the crude ladder to the blockhouse, scanning the whole valley from the top. A quarter mile away, he saw the rusty smudge of a dozen antelope pawing through the snow to nibble at sage. A big V of geese, wings locked to land, settled on the river. Otherwise, there were no signs of life.
Where are they?
He camped for two nights in the fort, unable to simply walk away from the destination he had so long pursued. Yet he knew his true aim was not a place, but two people. Two people and two final, vengeful acts. Glass followed the Yellowstone from Fort Union. He could only guess at Henry's path, but he doubted that the captain would risk a repeat of his failure on the Upper Missouri. That left the Yellowstone. He had followed the Yellowstone for 5 days when he crested a high bench above the river. He stopped, awestruck, fusing heaven to earth. The Bighorn Mountains stood before him. A few clouds swirled around the highest peaks, furthering the illusion of a wall reaching forever upward. His eyes watered from the glare of the sun against snow, but he could not look away. Nothing in Glass's 20 years on the plains had prepared him for such mountains. Captain Henry had spoken often of the enormity of the Rockies, but Glass assumed his stories were infused with the standard dose of campfire embellishment. In actuality, Glass thought, Henry's portrait had been woefully inadequate. Henry was a straightforward man, and his descriptions focused on the mountains as obstacles, barriers to be surmounted in the drive to connect a stream of commerce between east and west. Missing entirely from Henry's description had been any hint of the devout strength that flowed into Glass at the sight of the massive peaks. Of course, he understood Henry's more practical reaction. The terrain of the river valleys was difficult enough. Glass could scarcely imagine the effort required to portage firs over mountains such as those before him now. His awe of the mountains grew in the days that followed, as the Yellowstone River led him nearer and nearer. Their great mass was a marker, a benchmark fixed against time itself. Others might feel disquiet at the notion of something so much larger than themselves, but for Glass, there was a sense of sacrament that flowed from the mountains like a font, an immortality that made his quotidian pains seem inconsequential. And so he walked, day after day, toward the mountains at the end of the plain. Fitzgerald stood outside the crude stockade, enduring the interrogation of the runty, coughing man on the rampart above the gate. Fitzgerald had practiced the lie during his long days in the canoe.
I'm carrying a message to St. Louis for Captain Henry of the Rocky Mountain Fur Company.
Rocky Mountain Fur Company? The runty man snorted. We just saw another of yours headed in the other direction. Bad-mannered fella, riding double with a redskin. In fact, if you're from his company, you can make good on his draft.
Fitzgerald felt his stomach contract, and his breath drew suddenly short. The white man on the river. He struggled to keep his voice calm, nonchalant.
I must have missed him on the river. What was his name?
Don't even recall his name. We gave him a couple of things and he left.
What'd he look like?
Well, I do remember that. Scars all over his face, like he'd been chewed on by a wild animal.
Glass. Alive. God damn him.
Fitzgerald traded two plus for jerky, eager to get back on the water. No longer content to drift with the current, he paddled to propel the dugout forward, forward and away. Glass might be headed in the opposite direction, thought Fitzgerald, but he harbored no doubt
about the old bastard's intent.
21. December 31st, 1823. Snow began falling about halfway through the day. The storm clouds approached casually, obscuring the sun so gradually that Henry and his men took little notice. They had no reason to be concerned. Their refurbished fort stood complete, ready to withstand whatever challenges the elements might present. Besides, Captain Henry had declared the day a celebration. Then he had broken out a surprise that resulted in delirious excitement among his men. Alcohol. Henry was a failure at many things, but he understood the power of incentives. Henry's brew was made from yeast and service berries, buried for a month in a barrel to allow fermentation. The resulting concoction tasted like acid. None of the men could drink it without wincing in pain, and none of them passed up the opportunity. The liquid resulted in a profound and almost immediate state of drunkenness. Henry had a second bonus for his men. He was a decent fiddle player, and for the first time in months, his mood lifted sufficiently to pick up his battered instrument. The shrieking fiddle combined with drunken laughter to create a foundation of jovial chaos in the crowded bunkhouse. A good part of the merriment centered around Pig, whose obese carcass lay sprawled in front of the fireplace. Pig's capacity for alcohol, it turned out, did not match his girth.
"Looks like he's dead,"
said Black Harris, kicking him squarely in the belly. Harris's foot disappeared momentarily in the squishy fat around Pig's midsection. But otherwise, the kick evoked no response.
"Well, if he's dead,"
said Patrick Robinson, a quiet man who most of the trappers had never heard speak before the application of Henry's moonshine,
"we owe him a decent burial."
"Too cold," said another trapper, "but we could make him a proper shroud."
This idea evoked great enthusiasm among the men. Two blankets were produced, along with a needle and heavy thread. Robinson, an able tailor, began the task of tightly sewing the shroud around Pig's great mass. Black Harris delivered a moving sermon, and one by one, the men took turns with eulogies.
"He was a good man and a God-fearing man," said one speaker. "We return him to you, O Lord, in his virgin state, never once having been touched by soap."
"If you can manage the lift," said another, "we beseech you to hoist him up to the great beyond."
A loud argument diverted attention from Pig's funeral. Alistair Murphy and Stubby Bill had a difference of opinion over who between them was the finer shot with a pistol. Murphy challenged Stubby Bill to a duel, a notion that Captain Henry quickly quashed. However, he did authorize a shooting match. At first, Stubby Bill suggested they each shoot a tin cup from the other's head. Even in his drunken state, however, it occurred to him that such a contest might create a dangerous mixture of motivations. As a compromise, they ultimately decided to shoot a tin cup from Pig's head. Both Murphy and Stubby Bill considered Pig a friend, so both would have the appropriate incentive for marksmanship. They propped Pig's shroud-encased body in a sitting position against the wall, then placed a cup on his head. The men cleared a path down the center of the bunkhouse, with the shooters at one end and Pig at the other. Captain Henry hid a musket ball in one hand. Murphy picked correctly and elected to shoot second. Stubby Bill removed the pistol from his belt, carefully checking the powder in the pan. He adjusted his weight from foot to foot, ultimately situating himself sideways to his target. He bent his shooting arm to form a perfect right angle with the pistol pointing to the roof. His thumb reached up and cocked the pistol with a dramatic snap, the only sound in the tense cabin. After several pendulous moments in this position, he lowered the pistol to its firing position in a slow, graceful arc. Then he hesitated. The impact of an errant shot became suddenly palpable at the vision, through his pistol sights, of Pig's lumpy mass. Stubby Bill liked Pig, quite a lot, actually.
"This is a bad idea,"
He felt a bead of sweat trickle down his short spine. His peripheral vision made him newly aware of the men crowded on either side of him. His breathing became labored, causing his shooting arm to heave up and down. The pistol seemed suddenly heavy. He held his breath to stop the swaying, but then the lack of air made him lightheaded and dizzy.
Don't miss now.
Finally, he hoped for the best and squeezed the trigger, closing his eyes with the flash of the powder. The ball crashed into the log wall behind Pig, a full 12 inches above the cup on the fat man's shrouded head. The spectators erupted in laughter.
Nice shot, Stubby!
Murphy stepped forward. You think too much. In a single liquid motion, he drew, aimed, and fired. The shot exploded, and the bullet ripped into the base of the tin cup on Pig's head. The cup slammed against the wall before clamoring to the floor next to Pig. If neither shot killed Pig, the second at least succeeded in rousing him. The lumpy shroud began a series of wild contortions. The men cheered the shot, then doubled over in unbridled glee at the sight of the writhing shroud. The long blade of a knife thrust suddenly out from inside of the blanket, hacking open a narrow slit. Two hands appeared, ripping open the shroud. Next emerged Pig's fleshy face, blinking at the light. More laughter and taunts.
Like watching a calf get born.
The gunfire had sprinkled their celebration with fitting punctuation, and soon all the men began firing their weapons into the ceiling. Black powder smoke filled the room, along with hearty cries of Happy New Year!
Hey, Captain, said Murphy. We ought to fire off the cannon.
Henry had no objection, if for no other reason than to remove the trappers from the bunkhouse before they destroyed it. Clamoring loudly, the men of the Rocky Mountain Fur Company opened the door, stepped into the dark night, and stumbled en masse to the blockade. They were surprised at the intensity of the storm. The light dusting of the afternoon had degenerated into a full-bore blizzard, swirling winds driving heavy snow. 10 inches or more had accumulated, deeper still where drifts had formed. Had they been cogent, the men would have appreciated the good fortune that held the storm at bay while they constructed shelter. Instead, they focused entirely on the cannon. The 4-pound howitzer was really more of a giant shotgun than cannon, designed not for the ramparts of a fort, but for the bow of a keelboat. It was mounted on a swivel in the corner of the blockhouse, which allowed it to command 2 of the fort's walls. The iron tube measured barely 3 feet, with 3 trunnions for reinforcement. Insufficient, as it would turn out. A big man named Paul Hawker fancied himself the resident cannoneer. He even claimed to have been an artilleryman in the War of 1812. Most of the men doubted this claim, though they admitted that Hawker sounded authoritative when he barked out the drill for loading. Hawker and 2 other men scrambled up the ladder to the blockhouse. The rest stayed below, content to watch from the relative shelter of the parade ground.
"Cannoneers, to your posts!"
shouted Hawker. Hawker may have known the drill, but his subordinates clearly did not. They stared blankly, waiting for a civilian explanation of their responsibilities. Under his breath, Hawker pointed to one and said, "You grab the powder and some wadding." Pointing to the other, he said, "You go light the lanyard from the fire." Returning to his military bearing, he then shouted,
"Commence firing! Load!"
Under Hawker's direction, the man with the powder poured 30 drams into a measure, kept in the blockhouse for that purpose. Hawker tipped the brass muzzle of the cannon toward the sky, and they dumped in the powder. Next, they inserted a fist-sized wad of old cloth and used a ram staff to seat the charge firmly in the breech of the gun. While they waited for the return of the lanyard, Hawker unwrapped an oilcloth that held the primers, 3-inch sections of goose quill packed with gunpowder, and sealed at both ends with a dab of wax. One of these primers he placed in the small vent hole at the breech of the cannon. When the burning lanyard was set to the quill, it melted the wax and ignited the powder in the quill, which in turn set off the main charge in the breech. The man with the burning lanyard now made his way up the ladder. The lanyard was a long stick with a hole in the end. A thick piece of rope treated with saltpeter to make it burn threaded the hole. Hawker blew on the ember at the tip of the lanyard, the fiery glow casting an ominous red on his face. With the pomp of a West Point cadet, he screamed,
"Ready!"
The men below looked up at the blockhouse in eager anticipation of a colossal blast. Though he himself held the lanyard, Hawker yelled, "Fire!" and set the spark to the primer. The ember on the lanyard melted quickly through the wax. The primer sparked with a hiss and then... pop. Compared with the stupendous explosion they expected, the cannon's bark seemed barely louder than the clap of two hands.
"What the hell was that?"
came a cry from the yard, along with a sprinkling of catcalls and mocking laughter.
"Why don't you just bang on a pot?"
Hawker stared at his cannon, horrified that this moment of testicular exhibition had wilted so prominently. This had to be rectified.
"Just warming it up,"
he yelled down. Then, urgently,
"Cannoneers to your posts!"
His two cannoneers looked at Hawker dubiously now, suddenly mindful of the exposure of their own reputations.
"Move, you idiots!" hissed Hawker. "Triple the charge!"
More powder would help. Then again, maybe the problem had been too little wadding. More stuffing, reasoned Hawker, would create more resistance and a louder explosion.
"I'll give him a blast."
They poured the triple charge down the muzzle. What to use for wadding? Hawker ripped off his leather tunic and rammed it down the tube of the cannon.
"More."
Hawker looked at his assistant.
"Give me your tunics," he said to his crew.
The men stared back, clearly alarmed. "It's cold, Hawker."
"Give me your damn tunics."
The men reluctantly complied, and Hawker added these new garments to the wadding. The jeering continued as Hawker worked furiously to reload the big gun. By the time he finished, the entire length of the cannon had been filled with buckskin, tightly packed.
"Ready!"
yelled Hawker, reaching again for the burning lanyard.
"Fire!"
He set the spark to the primer, and the cannon exploded. Actually, exploded. The buckskin did indeed create additional resistance, so much so that the weapon blew itself into 1,000 glorious bits. For a brilliant moment, the fire of the blast lit the night sky. Then an enormous cloud of acrid smoke hid the blockhouse from view. The men ducked as shrapnel from the explosion ripped into the log walls of the fort and sunk hissing into the snow. The explosion knocked both of Hawker's crewmen over the edge of the blockhouse and into the yard below. One broke an arm in the fall, the other two ribs. Both might have died had they not managed to land in a deep snowdrift. As the driving wind cleared the smoke from the blockhouse, all eyes turned upward, searching for their brave artillerymen. No one said anything for a moment, until the captain yelled out,
"Hawker!"
Another long moment passed. The swirling winds pushed the smoke away from the blockhouse. They saw a hand reach over the edge of the rampart. A second hand appeared. And then, Hawker's head. His face was black as coal from the blast. His hat had been blown from his head, and blood trickled from both ears. Even with his hands on the blockhouse, he tottered from side to side. Most of the men expected him to pitch forward and die. Instead, he yelled,
"Happy New Year, you dirty sons of bitches!"
A great roar of approval filled the night. Hugh Glass stumbled in the drift, surprised that the snow could already be so deep. He wore no mitten on his shooting hand, so the fall thrust his bare flesh into the snow. The icy sting made him wince. He pushed his hand under his capote to dry it. The snow had begun as scattered flurries, hardly enough to justify fording up. Glass now realized his mistake. He looked around, trying to gauge the remaining daylight. The storm drew the horizon in close as the high mountains in the background disappeared altogether. He could make out a thin ridgeline of sandstone and the occasional pine sentinel. Otherwise, even the foothills seemed to fuse with the white-gray formless clouds of the sky. Glass was glad for the sure path of the Yellowstone. An hour before sunset? Glass pulled the mitten from his possibles bag and placed it on his stiff, damp hand. Nothing to shoot at in this weather anyway.
It had been 5 days since Glass struck out from Fort Union. He knew now that Henry and his men had come this way. The path of 30 men was not difficult to follow. From the maps he had studied, Glass remembered Manuelisa's abandoned trading post on the Bighorn. Surely, Henry would go no further, not in this season. He had a